basically how to reconcile those experiences in a way that a lot of it is it's just those are conflicting ideologies that exist at the same time. And so it's that double, that's where the term double consciousness comes from. And that kind of connects to the idea of in this being applied to the economic way of trying to reconcile and understand two things concurrently that are in multiple ways very contradictory.
Yeah. Yeah, literally, exactly. Because obviously he created the concept and explained the concept in an ethnic framework type of thing. But a lot of sociologists have taken it and applied it to class with Marxism and neo-Marxism and stuff.
Du Bois is definitely one of my favorites. Important thing to note is that he is the person who established the first school of sociology in the United States. But it is consistently given credit is given to a different white man. The fact that I always stand by. It's very important.
I remember that's the first thing you told me when you mentioned him.
Yes.
And then the other definitions I had written down as to just be aware of are the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, which we have gone over. But just to recap, the proletariat are the working class in a capitalist society. They just have their labor to sell to survive. And the bourgeoisie is the ruling class, where they are owning the means of production and they profit from the labor that is given by the proletariats. And then I also had nuclear family ideology, and that's just if we have a chance to talk about Marxism and gender. But for those of you who don't know what it is, it's a belief that the nuclear family is the ideal or normal, in quotations, family structure, and it reinforces gender roles and capitalist interests, which is where it's a heterosexual married couple and their biological children. That is your nuclear family ideology. And that's the, I'm pretty sure, like, every kind of key term you're going to need to know. When we are discussing Marxism,
play a song really quick and we'll come back and start.
Yeah,
our
I hope everyone can ponder over those and not forget them.
Yeah, it's okay. We'll keep them in touch.
Yeah.
This song is it's my shout out song to Zoe.
Nice.
So this song to Zoe, if she's listening, we will listen to it when we're soccer moms, and this is gonna be us. Okay, sounds good.
You can hold my hand when you need to let go. I can be a mountain when you're feeling valley low. I can be a street light showing you the way home. 'Cause you can hold my hand when you need to let go. Table and a place by the fire forever.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Aluminum is not just found in soda and beer cans. The material is used in all sorts of things, from cell phones and solar panels to electric vehicles and airplanes. And demand for many of these products is growing rapidly.
So not only is demand increasing here in the United States, but it's increasing around the world, which adds up to a whole lot more aluminum.
Annie Sartor is with Industrious Labs, an organization focused on reducing the climate impact of aluminum and other industrial materials. She says aluminum production requires a lot of electricity, and in places like China, where more than half of the world's aluminum is produced, much of that electricity comes from burning coal, so it creates a lot of global warming carbon pollution. But in places where more electricity comes from renewables, for example Canada, which uses a lot of hydropower, the climate impact is far less. Sartor says in many areas, renewable energy is becoming cost competitive.
Coal is not as cheap as it was comparatively around the world anymore.
So she says there's an opportunity for the industry to switch to using more clean energy and limit the harm aluminum production has on the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases. From any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Welcome back to Sociologic. We're broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain on CJSF 90.1 FM. Today it's our theory deep dive. We're talking about Karl Marx. If you are just tuning in, we just went over a lot of definitions of things that we're going to be using in a discussion, and now we're going to get started with that discussion.
Hell yeah. Who's starting?
Okay, we have some questions that, do you want to put
You know what? You go ahead. You start the question.
So I might take one of these and spin it a little bit. So basically, a lot of what Karl Marx is applied to when you're learning about him is capitalism. He has a whole piece called Capital, where he critiques capitalism, and this is all of his proletariat are going to overtake the bourgeoisie because capitalism is all of the wrong in the world. He writes very dramatically, actually. He's a bit of a drama queen.
Can you tell what was on his mind 24/7?
But also, fair enough, because you think about the conditions he saw. People were working in factories. People were starving. There was a lot of super rich people, or a handful of super rich people, the elite, the bourgeoisie, and everybody else was suffering a lot.
Especially as well, considering that he married his wife who was from money, and he wasn't.
She wasn't a lot of money.
No, but like he's seeing the two sides, right? If you're seeing the two sides, it changes your perspective a lot when you don't come from money and then suddenly you get access to money. You know what it was like before than if you just come from money, you know?
Okay, well, maybe she wasn't rich. Somebody else's wife was rich. I might have mixed that up because I was confused about why the jacket thing was happening simultaneously. Mm. Disregard that.
But I'm also intrigued because I know that both him and his wife, born in Germany, they're both German, yet they both died in England. Their kids are born in England. Mm-hmm. So they've come from Germany to England. I want to know how that happened.
Yeah,
I
we'll know definitely why. Have to follow that.
Yeah.
But basically,
sorry, sidetracking.
let's talk about how are Karl Marx's ideas applicable today.
Yeah.
We already talked about the do what you love idea. So a big thing that Marx talked about is alienation. There's alienation of the workers, so between each other. So this comes from the division of labor. So we see that in the descaling of labor prior to the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of people who had their, it was very trade based. You'd like have an apprentice and you'd learn how to do this thing and you'd be really good at doing it and you'd do the whole process. Mm-hmm. So like say this table was going to be made, I would make the entire table, you know, and as the factories got involved, etc., there was the de-skilling of labor because it makes it a lot faster. If we're making a shirt, I'm just making the hand, the wrist cuffs, mm-hmm. or whatever they're called. I'm just making the buttons. And it becomes that super repetitive. People are being de-skilled, and therefore are, and because everybody's being divided and working on different things, there's an alienation of the worker.
I think as well, just like on that topic, mm-hmm. if I, because you said you don't know much about neo-Marxism and we're talking about how this is applicable like now and how is it relevant now.
Yeah.
There is a neo-Marxist called Braverman who was writing about 1974, 1975, yeah. who used that kind of concept and called it the proletarianization of the middle class, mm-hmm. where it was essentially the same thing but happening to the middle class, mm-hmm. in that middle class workers were being de-skilled due to machinery, and that the fact the working class were being able to do the same skilled work as them, that it led to the middle class being polarized into the same class as the working class, basically merging middle class into the proletariats, and that like reduced the control workers had over the process. Employers could pay even lower wages. They lost all control. Mm-hmm. They became alienated. And then it was a greater profit for the ruling class and capitalist system to put the middle class in with the working class.
For sure.
Through this. So it's the, if we're talking about like how it was applicable from like Marx's time, who's in the 1800s, you have a neo-Marxist talking about it happening in a mm-hmm. different way, but still happening in the 1970s, like mid-1970s.
Yeah.
So it was for definitely sure. still no, applicable
it,
to
it an, follows yeah. along. Yeah. And then also now, I mean,
a I mean, lot look of, at like AI now.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
A lots of different things. There, he talks a lot about this alienation thing. There's also alienation from the boss. So like the boss and like, I don't know if you see that with like the divide between you and your managers. Like you're not always buddy-buddy in the same way. There's different things. There's also mm-hmm. alienation. There's a couple more, but the one that I'm thinking of that's also relevant is alienation from your work. So because we're no longer doing it, like our work is not like our passion projects. It's not, it's just you do it and it's done. And it's, you don't have that super, like, again, back to the table idea. Like if I make a whole table, I'm very connected to this work. And, or yeah, you're alienated from the products and the stuff, mm-hmm. and also because your work is just so minimized. Like if I bought a custom made table, I'd be like, oh yeah, this is Rebecca's third edition wood chestnut.
It's got some green on it
with the emerald lining, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But if I go to IKEA, I buy this table. Somebody made that, somebody shipped it, somebody wrote the instructions, all of these things, mm-hmm. right? But those people are no longer part of it, and we don't think about that anymore. And all of it is just done by this transaction of money. Mm-hmm. Like, what makes it so that, like, a t-shirt and a bowl of really nice spaghetti are the same, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Is that they cost $25, right? You know? Yeah. And that's crazy how we just are able to equate things, and Marx talks about that a lot, about, like, that kind of goes into his ideas of fetishization. And that's all super relevant today, where you're, especially with the issues around fast fashion, this comes up where there's, you're buying this because it's cheap. And yeah, and of course you're trying to buy something cheap because you're being, you're not making enough money to be able to buy other things, right? Mm-hmm. And also there's all of these ideas being fed into your head that, yes, you need to be buying more, you need to be buying more, and that's capitalism. Like, oh, like all your clothes are out of date, you need to go get the new ones, and that's where the fast fashion ideas.
Trends have changed.
Yeah, they go super fast with social media. But as a result, there's those people who are being exploited even more than you are, and like are being very brutally put through these horrible working conditions to create these clothes for us to buy, and that's the alienation from of them too, from the products that they're making. And sometimes that alienation, Like, I remember there was this whole thing where some clothes from Zara, like, kept having things stitched into them, like, calls for help.
Oh, I saw that for Shein.
Yeah. Yeah. Try and raise awareness. People were stitching things in. And that's kind of a way to mess with that, to throw a wrench in that idea of alienation, because it reminds you that there's these people that are going into this. Everything you have around you is made by somebody, got to you because of the work of different people. But that's very much removed from that process, because you just go to your store, or even you don't go to a store, you buy it on Amazon.
Yeah. You know? I think similarly as well, but also slightly different. I remember looking at Marxism and alienation in the terms of that the working class, because they have no control over their labor, they're just selling their labor. They have like no control over it. They end up not having any work satisfaction coming from their job.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up looking for it elsewhere. And where do they get it from? Is consumerism and in consumer goods, which then further fuels profit and production for the ruling class, which further fuels capitalism. And that's kind of the form of alienation we were like heavily focused in on, because we looked a lot at consumerism and like the American dream and capitalism selling like the idea that happiness comes from materialism and buying things and your individual gain that way. And you end up getting so kind of obsessed in this idea that you don't end up questioning the systemic inequalities or anything. And I'd say like one really big example of this, and it's not in everywhere, but I know it's big in the States, not so much the UK, but Black Friday. Black Friday, where you have all of these discounted goods and stuff, and it's often from the companies that are exploiting workers, like you said, like Shein, Amazon, these kind of like businesses, big businesses.
I mean, everybody participates in Black Friday. It's so big there. It's also, oh my gosh.
It's like, it's global, but I think it's, like, I remember seeing videos, like, maybe the UK does more Black Friday online than, like, stores, but I remember seeing videos of the US. Monday. Yeah, because I remember seeing the videos of the US, and it's like everyone is, like, cramming into the shopping malls and stuff. And in the UK, it was not like that.
People throw hands. People go to the hospital. It's intense.
All over buying discounted stuff. Yeah. Which is fueling the capitalist idea, because the consumerism is distracting people from questioning the capitalism and questioning the exploitation that happened to get those products to you and things.
It's funny to me that this is just my little American laughing of the fact that for everybody else, it just falls on a random Friday. But for us, it's the Friday after Thanksgiving is how like we do it. And so it's just funny that it'll just be like a random Friday for everybody else. I think
it's like just it's the last Friday of November.
Well, yeah, because
in the UK, I want to say. I don't know if the UK Black Friday is the same Black Friday date, because the UK, like our Mother's Day is different. Fair enough. Father's Day different. So our Black Friday day is probably different.
Well, because Thanksgiving for us is always the fourth Thursday of every month.
Okay,
the last Thursday, fourth Thursday.
Okay, then yeah, it's the same, because ours is the last Friday of the month. Yeah. But also with this idea, I kind of wanted to link it a bit to like meritocracy.
Because
you have like this false class consciousness with consumerism, and then there's the idea, obviously, that anyone can make it if they work hard enough, which is linked with the American dream, which is linked with consumerism, which is linked to like material gain and showing your status through your items and your clothing and everything. And I wanted to actually know if you think that I had a question and it's gone. To what extent do you believe in a meritocratic system? That is a long-winded word.
I mean,
because like there are some very, to me, some very, very clear no-nos with it, in that where that it's like it's pitfalls. But I think like underlying it, if you didn't have it, would people put work and effort in still?
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. I think that I could see meritocracy working really well in a non-capitalist system, right? Where in a capitalist system, the main thing is that everybody is being turned into a profit machine. And mm-hmm. so you're trying to get the most gain. Everybody else is trying to get the most gain. And how that works is if my product that I'm selling becomes more competitive than yours, I will push you out of the market. That doesn't necessarily mean that my product is better than yours. It just means that I was able to do things differently in the market to make my product better than yours. And so it doesn't, but then because of that, you will have a much harder, after I've pushed you out, you won't be able to like come back from that all the time. There's, because I already own the market now, like Amazon, right? Like how is any online company gonna, like online selling company gonna be able to compete with that? Like they can't, because Amazon has the monopoly and all of that.
Yeah.
But I do think that the idea of meritocracy, this is just also because I think that, I mean, maybe I'm saying all of this because I've been raised in America with the American dream, or like it makes sense that people should be rewarded for hard work. That makes sense to me, but I also grew up in America where that's what we are told. So that's like an interesting little self-fulfilling cycle right there. But I do think it would be really cool if that was how it works, because that would also, like, for this to work, we would have to be in, like, an anti-racist and non-capitalistic society, because and a non-colonial society as well. So a lot of things would have to change for it to work in the way that it could, where, like, you are rewarded equally for the amount of work you do and how well you do it. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because I would say the same. Like, I've grown up in, obviously, England, the UK, like, it's a very much a similar ideology that I've had instilled in me since I was born, like, whilst I was raised, is that hard work equals success. You should get rewarded off of what you put in. And I think, like, that on its own of, like, the idea that you should be rewarded based off of the work that you put into it is something that should happen, but I agree that in the framework of how society is structured now, it doesn't work, because meritocracy, for people that don't know, like, I feel like it's been explained, but just in case, a meritocracy is a system where success and status are based on your ability, effort, or talent rather than wealth, background, and things. But it doesn't really work because it assumes everyone has an equal opportunity. And that's not true because of structural barriers and inequalities. We know that. So I think the same as you is that the if we didn't, I feel like without meritocracy, I wonder if people would put in as much effort to try and succeed. Because if you're not getting rewarded on it, that's kind of the incentive. It just doesn't work in the framework that we have it, because it just ignores the barriers, assuming everyone is starts on the same level.
Well, there would have to be different incentives, right? Like, we think about, like your whole thing about being rewarded, that's capitalism talking, right? But if we're going back to other, to pre-capitalist societies, there's, like, the ideas of collectivity and reciprocity, where you're working together as a group. You're all trying to work together for this collective that you live with. I give something to you, you'll give something to me at some point. Like, it's not like I'm paying you for this service.
But rewarded like could not, doesn't necessarily mean monetary.
Well, yeah, that idea is still capitalist. You should be getting something, and like that like comes with that. It stems from that. Whereas like the idea of like collectivity and reciprocity, like I'm not always gonna get something in return, or like I might not always get an equivalent in return. That's where like trade cultures to like you're trying to get something even, but not all, it won't be like exactly even, it'll be different things, like service training, trading for sure.
Interesting. Interesting food for thought,
right?
Meritocracy or no meritocracy.
For sure. Do we want to chat through?
I was thinking, like, the next question I have, I feel like we could, it kind of sums up Marxism, I think. In which that, like, Marxist and neo-Marxist theories, are they too deterministic, or do they have room for individual agency and resistance? because obviously Marxism and neo-Marxism are outdated compared to contemporary society when they were created, like now. So
they're still relevant, though.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about like how, like when I say like too deterministic, are they too simple now for contemporary society? Is contemporary society too complex? Or
I mean, something that's talked about a lot is how Marxism doesn't necessarily address gender. Mm-hmm. And
you have Marxist feminism as a branch of feminism more than Marxism.
Yeah, it's just like, but if you're going strictly off of what Marx talked about, like, he's not great. The only inequality he talks about is worker inequality, and so that's disregarding other, like, inequalities that exist. It's not very intersectional, so that's why I would say, like, it's really lacking intersectionality.
Yeah. Because I think as well, like, we look at, like, sociology now, and we've got a rise in, like, postmodernism theory, where we talk about, it's sociologists talking a lot more about the impact of individual agency and choice. Mm-hmm. And people aren't necessarily choosing to do things because of a reaction to an inequality. And there's other reasons behind it. Like, specifically in how I think about this is to do with deviancy and youth deviancy particularly. There's an increase in theories talking about how people do it for the thrill of the risk, thrill of getting caught when you don't have many responsibilities going through the transition of like a teenager and adolescence. But then there's like the theories before would say that it was a reaction of class oppression.
I mean, yeah, you could totally tie it to that, being like, well, it, as a worker not having to be trained to be super skilled in something, you have more time on your hands, and also you're like alienated from the work and from other people, so you don't feel that responsibility to not be deviant. You don't feel the same responsibility to society because you've been so alienated, so you could totally tie it in that way.
Because I know there's increasing talk on like individual agency within sociology, of like, that's where a lot of the classic theories have pitfalls, is they don't take into account individual agency as much. Particularly Marx, he says everything is coming from a class reasoning and reaction.
He's very much
And neo-Marxism is similar, but they offer a bit more intersectionality, I feel, and they talk a lot more about cultural institutions like the media and the education and things.
I mean, there's just more going on. There's more factors at play. So I think that for sure it's not applicable in the same way, but I don't think it should be thrown out the window, because I think the fact that we're still talking to it to the extent that we are shows how, in his eye, like in Marx's eyes, he would be like, wow, like we have had no progress. Because if you look, like, people are still being oppressed. Even more so, like, the rich are super rich, the 1%, they're like richest 1% have so much money in comparison to the rest of the world, and you can talk about the ethicality of that and all of that, but he would be flabbergasted.
No, definitely. Also, that's also because it's like, it's one of the foundational theories as well when you study sociology. Marxism is one of the foundational theories that you get taught. So the fact it's that, and it's from so long ago, but you can still find examples of it today, will show how it's still applicable, maybe not in the same way, but to an extent.
Yeah. I think Marx gets a bad rap because, specifically like in neoliberal society, because he wrote the Communist Manifesto, and people are not thrilled about communism in neoliberal societies, but he has a lot of really important things to say. And also, the Communist Manifesto is like, it definitely, I don't know, like, he gets a bad rap, basically.
That's all we have time for. Stay tuned for Connor and Bitcuva coming up from 8 till 10.
Thanks, y'all. Bye. See ya. Bitcuva.